And Jason, Jason, my friend, you look like too callow a youth to take on the kind of warfare that needs to be taken on in Alberta. I think you need the strength of 10 because your heart is pure. But where is the strength of 10? I don't know. But seriously, Mr. Manning, in an op-ed page on the editorial of the page of the Globe, observed that he thought the next election ought to be fought in Alberta on the issue of land planning. You remember that, probably, that editorial. Now, that's coming from someone very distinguished in Canada and very distinguished in this province, speaking directly to the provincial government of this province of the abuses of land that have been characterized under the Tory administration. Now, this makes me want to, and I'll be very quick, I just have to have some housekeeping questions from you, because I need to know that you're a charitable organization. Presumably you're registered by the federal government as a charitable organization. Presumably then people get receipts for income tax deductions. And presumably people give to you and your organization for a purpose with a hook to it. It's just not sweet charity, it's something else. Now I want to know, do you howl? Have you got the freedom to howl as an organization which is under the Government Charities Act, which I don't think you have the freedom to howl, about some driller who goes to put an oil well in the park? You can't say anything about that, or can you? I don't know. Or some road issue that's just as screamingly stupid across an aisle, across a pathway for animals. Cheryl Bradley here knows everything, and Sylvia too, about those kind of issues, and we wanted to know, I suppose. I could ask you, where were you then when the wars were fought? We welcome you here. This is not a critical question. We're just wanting to know where you're coming from and what you're doing, because you're a very important person. Poor lawyers cost a lot of money, and their assistants in their office and the rest. We want to know what you're doing. Is that all right? Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll just point out, poor not-for-profit lawyers. So. The center itself its mission is basically to see a clean, healthy, and diverse environment wherein the laws and policy are protective of that environment. And to that end, we see public participation and effective enforcement of effective laws as central to a healthy environment. And further to that end, I would comment on those things if they were a result of what we at the center viewed as inadequate laws and policy. So if a road was the subject of an environmental impact assessment that didn't meet all the standards in the Environmental Protection and Enhancement Act, then we'd probably comment on that. As a charity, you're correct in saying that political advocacy is not our role as a charity. It's more education and that type of thing. Where does our money come from? Good question. The bulk of our core funding comes from the Alberta Law Foundation, which is a foundation in Alberta that gets their money through basically all the trust accounts, whether it's a real estate deal or other legal issues. When interest accrues in trust accounts, if the client doesn't wish to have it, then it goes to Alberta Law Foundation, and they spread it around to different organizations, social and ours as well. And then also, I should mention one other thing, is that some of our funding also comes through a search service we have at the center, through which you can search for environmental enforcement activities historically or well site reclamation issues. And that is by contract through Alberta Environment. And that all goes to our public funds as well. Otherwise, I'm not sure if there is a hook if people give a charitable donation to the center. I mean, certainly we wish to see environmental laws and policies be as effective as possible to ensure that we have a clean and healthy environment.
Thank you.
Well, we're hopefully creating awareness about the laws that exist and possibly how the laws can be changed. So, and then we rely on the broader public to bring forth their ideas and to use that information in a political manner if they see fit. I mean, that's as a charity, as you know, if charitable organizations are excessively advocacy oriented, then their charitable status is at risk. So certainly the Environmental Law Center has a mission in terms of education and awareness and public participation. And hopefully good decisions are made from that. It's probably not as direct an answer as you might want.
Anybody else, please?
I just like your comment on the fact that in, I think it was in the mid-90s, my name is Sylvia Campbell, in the mid-90s, the Alberta government did away with the whole structure for regional planning. And I'm wondering whether you see that, I know you probably know a little bit of the history of that, and whether or not the situation has worsened as a result of doing away with this, and whether you think there's any possibility of citizen pressure to bring it back.
Well, I know the provincial government is talking about community-based or regionally-based planning. Sorry. I know that the province is currently in a kind of a beginning phase, which I don't know a lot about producing a land use framework, which could possibly address some regional issues. And a lot of talk recently is about community or regionally based planning. And historically, initiatives have started up but then fallen to the wayside for whatever reason. Political will may have been a reason back then. But there seems to be another push to get a planning policy that's effectively applied in place. But it hasn't hit the public realm yet, as far as I'm aware, anyway.
They're pragmatic, I guess. I hear a lot of theory, and I did follow most of what you said. But I would like to have some examples. For instance, what happened when Lethbridge said, no, we don't want a hog-producing plant, and we didn't get it? I mean, that's participation. What happened just outside of Waterton? We fought and fought. But we lost that one. There's development just outside Waterton. Do you know of these two examples, and can you give us a more practical idea of what you're talking about?
Those are two great examples. In terms of the intensive livestock operation, I would say that certainly if a critical mass is reached in a community, that there's enough public pressure to guide development at that point. But when you're dealing with property issues, as I was referring to earlier, and the right to develop that property, I think, and subdivision rights themselves are quite entrenched in the legislation, so that's part of the problem there. And whether or not the municipality chose to allow that development or not, obviously, it's a contentious issue, but often enough, the subdivision authority is guided by the Municipal Government Act, which it limits their ability to refuse to subdivide certain properties, although they probably had to rezone that area as well, so that's another question. And again, critical mass, I think, is the key thing in public participation.
Howard Forsyth, the previous speaker mentioned the event at Waterton Gate, which a lot of us call the Garner decision, because that's the man that pushed it and owned the land. I was pretty close to that, and I was present when the chairman of the Clarkston County Commission, Royce Jacobs, in connection with his and the council's commission, the council's decision to approve that project, Roy Jacobs said, property is a God-given right. I was publishing a newspaper down there, and I said, hey, it's not in the Book of Mormon, and that's mostly Mormon country. It's not in the Bible. What is property? I think you've given us quite a lot of information about that. My question is, they followed up in Cardston County with a modified plan so as not to get into a nasty corner as they were on the Gardner decision. The plan is that if you own a quarter section in Cardston County, you are permitted to split it into two 80s, and each 80 is permitted a 5-acre piece to be taken off for residences by Calgary-type people and others, and you can still put two more houses on it. That's four houses on a quarter section. Well, I own a quarter section since that decision, right up there close to Waterton, and there is a two 5-acre split-offs, and so that's the kind of, and we're fitted two more houses on there. That's the kind of development that followed after the disastrous Gardner decision. How does this fit into your notion of what's good land planning?
Well, I think it certainly, while a certain battle might have to use war type metaphors here, certain battles might be lost, and certainly some people, I'm sure, feel that many battles in Alberta have been lost. But certainly, I think the more those battles come up in the public awareness, that changes development. And of course, we need to ensure that the next plan is better to deal with that issue. And certainly getting the planners and the councillors involved and ensuring they're aware of the broad opposition to it is part of that process. But again, it's a really hard issue because private landowners have very strong thoughts about their rights, as you pointed out.
Good afternoon, honorable ladies, gentlemen, and people of distinguished decorum of the university. I've been farming all my life, and I've been studying different things. Some college, some university, a little bit, but then I had this situation. I bought from Brown Elkinar $7,500 irrigating rights. I would have got free pipe, 1-inch thick, plastic pipe water, and electricity for life. And here this guy wouldn't irrigate. And now he turns around and he sues me for not letting him. So I lost somehow by settling out of court, but put that aside, leave names aside. And yet there was no protection from me. The lawyer told me to settle out of court, and that was not good. I had zero protection there. But now people want to put water on. I subdivided too, but never mind that. There's issues like when you buy the right for irrigate, the last water rights, and then somebody turns dog on you. My son should sue him because he never gets the farm, he never gets the buildings or anything because of the messy lawsuit that I lost. And the guy snoops in and knows what buildings I had, and he put conditions and everything in. I had to sell everything just to please that farmer that went in the wrong. The lawyers let himself be bought off in the wrong. But where is the protection for an owner and for the home quarter? I simply didn't have any for my home quarter. I've lost the vehicles and everything I stand for. So now I want to see human rights put in place for guys like me and other people, other farmers and other acreage owners, so that they can feel happy and say, I live in a good Canadian country with freedom and a lot of human rights and ownership rights and rights to do things to make it go, the wheel go around. Everything, what goes around comes around, happy-go-lucky for everybody concerned. And I'm thanking you very much for my time.
What can you say about it?
Well, I think certainly rights to property and rights to make a living, certainly that's an issue for how land is developed. And I think also recognizing rights or needs to recognize the importance of environmental health in incorporating those rights and encouraging them to be sustained by property owners is also important. But yeah, sounds like good idea. I just wanted to also quickly mention an Environmental Law Center publication that was, it's called The Municipal Powers, Land Use Planning and the Environment, Understanding the Public's Role. And it's a publication of the Environmental Law Center. It's available free on our website, which is www.elc.ab.ca. So it's free on the website, or it's $15 for a hard copy, paying for the trees.
Anybody else?
Dwayne Pendergast, Jason. There is a Canadian Environmental Assessment Act that I'm a little bit familiar with. I believe it calls for public input. There must be an equivalent Alberta Act. Could you tell us about that?
Certainly, both provincially and federally, there's environmental assessment legislation. In Alberta, it's the Environmental Protection and Enhancement Act, and the regulations regulated with that. And that dictates which activities require that environmental impact assessments are done for particular activities. It's a big topic, and often issues revolving around environmental impact assessments are whether or not things could be properly mitigated, and issues surrounding whether discretion of the government is properly upholding the purpose of that legislation. So if you have a particular question about environmental assessments, I'm not sure, but there is provincial legislation in place for environmental assessment. And the regulations dictate certain activities where it's required. Otherwise, a lot of operations go ahead without EIAs being required.
Jason, based on the review of municipal powers and land use planning and public involvement, I'm wondering if the Law Center has come to any conclusions about the adequacy of public involvement and how some of these processes may be improved, or if you think the status quo is okay in terms of protecting the environment.
Basically, I'd say that certainly for municipal land use planning, there's certainly room for improvement in the public participation realm. I think there's also room for a provincial land use framework to guide municipalities' actions in that regard. Really, the participation that is there isn't probably as used as it should be. And so creating that awareness in the broader community is really important. And to that end, I mean, there's several mechanisms. The province can play a role there as well. And the municipality itself can attempt to broaden their public input opportunity. But certainly there's room for improvement.
Anybody else? One more, the last one.
Thanks, Jason. My name is James Moore. I have a question. I wonder, with the Chapter 11 in NAFTA, the provision where companies, corporations can sue governments for preventing them from making a profit. I know there was an instance in Mexico where toxic waste was, you know, the cleaning up of the toxic waste would prevent the company from making a profit. And they were ruled under Chapter 11 that, in fact, they had the, not that they had the right to toxic waste, but the government of Mexico was obligated to compensate them. I wonder if, you know, in terms of Alberta, if you see any implications here in that regard.
Certainly, I think the Chapter 11 issues which allow for environmentally harmful products to be continue to be traded is an issue in all in North America generally. In terms of Alberta in particular, just to certainly there's certain issues with how land is being developed and some of the wastes that are being produced and how those wastes are going to be treated or disposed of might raise similar issues in terms of if those if there's attempts to export waste and that type of thing. I'm just wondering if there is something in your mind that you had thought might raise a Chapter 11 argument? Or
I guess...
yes, just recently I've been thinking about this because every week now we're reading 5 billion, 10 billion in the Athabasca Basin. And, like, this is so huge, the amount of pollution, what's happening there. So I'm just sort of speculating ahead a little bit and wondering, okay, are those companies, you know, will they be able to make these kind of arguments about the pollution relative to Alberta's ability to regulate? And I know that they'll want to. Could you just comment on that particularity?
Well, certainly the oil sands development has large implications across the province and the nation. In terms of trade issues, it would probably have to be tied to oil trade with the U.S. or Mexico. There is the possibility, I guess, that argument could be made. That is to say, if there were attempts to regulate or to slow down oil and oil sands development, although I don't foresee that in the near future, but certainly, typically, from my understanding, Chapter 11 deals with the export more with the trade issues, as opposed to just the production of pollution activities and then regulating them domestically. So I know of one case where Canada tried to regulate a substance that was being imported from the U.S. because they didn't think it was meeting health standards. And that company in the U.S. challenged the Canadian government, and they had to pay compensation there as well. So I think you'd have to tie it to trade in that manner. And, of course, the pollution often is transboundary and doesn't really care what border it crosses. So that's a huge issue, nevertheless.
Terry, one more for you.
Thank you, Terry Shellington. I'd just like to frame Cheryl's question maybe a little more rudely, but Cheryl's very polite. But watching the environmental issues unfold in the province, it seems like the rights are wildly balanced in favor of landowners who have land contiguous to whatever road is going across or whatever, but in terms of who speaks for the grizzlies or some of these things, the battle seemed quite out of balance. And are you saying that that really the you didn't answer her question very specifically about what needs to be changed about environmental laws and to protect the environment? Is it simply a matter of people being political and calling meetings and so on? Because I observe in the politics of this that the land, that the oil developers golf at the same golf course as the shapers of government policy, and there's quite a bit of fraternity here And people who care about the grizzlies may find out quite a bit later down the road after some investment has been made. So just how could the environment be better protected? And is it simply a political matter, or are there some specific changes that maybe some other jurisdictions have exercised that would give a little more balance to the fight between environment and jobs?
That's a great question and a tough one. I would say that certainly there's legislative reforms could help in that. Something that's often also discussed is, because of your comment about who's talking for the grizzlies or the trees or whatever, there's often a discussion around, more academic discussion, in terms of constitutional changes, in terms of recognizing environmental values in that regard. And that would encompass all legislation, because it would be a constitutional issue or a Bill of Rights type of idea. Now, actually getting such a Bill of Rights in place would require the political will, as you note, and as does any legislative change. But certainly at this point, I think that the policy initiatives by the government and participation in those is part of creating that public wave of change that could affect changes in laws and changes in how we do things later on. In terms of other jurisdictions, it's really hard to pick out one jurisdiction that's doing excellent all around. There's certainly municipalities that are trying to control their growth and grow smartly and that type of thing, and there's other land use policies out there that are probably or could be said to be more effective. But again, there is a need for legislative change to do that. And again, it goes back to your political question. So again, I don't think I answered the question, but it's a tough one.
Gordon, can you come up? Sorry to impose upon you. Terry, maybe it would be important for environmentally concerned people to join these golf clubs.
Jason, I hope you don't think that we have been truculent in our. I hope you don't think we have been truculent in our questions to you. So I want to be kind. What I want to do is ask a favor. I'd like you to bear a message back to the chairman of your board. The message is not back from the Council of Public Affairs. The message is an individual, one person in the Council of Public Affairs, who would ask this board to which you belong be detached from the law association, and therefore be detached as a charitable organization, and therefore be equipped to be an agent to bring the law more intelligently in touch with economic reality and social reality and the political desires of the people to care about the life of the forests and the incident down here that you know about. Piles of letters and petitions and things were gathered that weren't read. They were dispatched like that, and this is going ahead. You know that situation. And you can't, I see, by the legislation, do anything about it, or even indeed speak about it. So I would like you to bring back to your board this request that one person asks this board, excellent people that you have, I'm sure, to be detached from the Law Society, to be detached from the charitable rights organization, in order that you can be proactive for environmental and land reforms that desperately need to be done in this province and that have been neglected in this province.
I'll certainly take that back, and I'm sure there will be quite a bit of interest in that suggestion, and certainly a lot of value in terms of being able to advocate on behalf of better land use planning. So I'll certainly take that back to the center and see which one of us can be convinced to take on that torch.
Well, thank you very, very much for your participation and your questions and so on, and the viewers of Shaw Cable. And collectively, I asked you to thank Jason Unger for his excellent contribution and review of the process of land management in Alberta. Thank you, Jason.